Hi there, my name is Jamie Mackay and I lead the Postgraduate Learning and Teaching programmes at the Royal Conservatoire of Scotland. The following podcast is part of a series of interviews with graduates of the part-time M.Ed in Learning and Teaching in the Arts programme. This programme is delivered on a blended learning model but can also be studied fully remotely. All participants on the programme have a role as an arts educator and the programme is designed to help them develop their teaching practice and their arts practice, and it culminates in a self-designed final project. For more information on the programme, check the website on rcs.ac.uk/med. In this podcast, I'm very pleased to be interviewing Louise Marshall. Louise is a producer for dance and accessible arts as part of the engagement team at Eden Court in Inverness. Louise has been developing and delivering participatory and community dance classes and projects for all ages and abilities for 25 years. Louise completed her M.Ed in 2020, focusing on dance, adolescence, identifying as female and femininity. Since completion, she has presented sessions on this topic, most recently at the International Teaching Artists Collaborative Conference in Oslo. Louise is also a trustee for People Dancing UK. Could you introduce yourself and say a little about your current role as an arts educator?
I'm Louise Marshall. I live up in the north of Scotland, just north of Inverness, and I'm currently, my title is very long-winded, the producer for dance and accessible arts within the engagement team at Eden Court. So Eden Court is the theatre venue, arts venue in Inverness, but we serve the Highland region, or we certainly try to. And we have two theatres, two cinemas, two studios. I sit within the engagement team, which has had various different names over the years, depending on the focus, but, you know, outreach or education or, you know, whatever, creative learning, whatever you want to call it. So everyone within the engagement team are teaching artists. So they all have their own practice. And then we deliver a whole range of classes and projects and so on, both within Eden Court, the venue, but also to other groups and schools and so on across the Highlands, depending on what the focus of the work is at any given time and what the funding is, which obviously is very important. So most of what I do is dance-based, dance-related, and my role as well as direct delivery. So I'm teaching all ages, all abilities, you know, in different groups and sessions. And within that, you know, is my role to make that as accessible to everyone as possible. But I'm also facilitating projects and, you know, being a project manager, event manager, you know, where there's other people delivering as well. So it's not just, it's not all about me, but at the moment it's quite a lot focused on, you know, yeah, me, just because of coming out of COVID and restructuring and so forth that we've had to do to adapt to the current circumstances. That's a very brief intro, I think.
Yeah, thank you very much. So when you're working with learners, what's your goal?
My initial goal always is for whatever group it is, for it to be accessible. You know, lots of people, as I'm sure you will know, will say, I can't dance, which is not true. Everyone can dance. They just need to find their groove. Whether it's deemed, you know, appropriate dance to put on a stage or whatever, maybe another question, but it's, you know, that's not what I'm about. Some of the people come and they want to perform and they want to pursue that pathway. But my initial goal is that they come in and they feel comfortable to move and dance and feel that they can do that. So that's the first goal. And, you know, and that's in some ways that's different for every group, but often it's the same for every group. You start from the same starting point in terms of how you approach it, what you, you know, how you welcome people, your pedagogy, and then what you actually physically do in the class. And then it diversifies more as you get into the work kind of thing. But the initial thing is often very similar for every group. Beyond that, I suppose then I want to light a spark. I want to, you know, my goal is for people to find their joy, find their passion and dance, and to appreciate that dance does so much more than just learning to dance, if you know what I mean. It does so much more beyond the physical. And so within, with my broader hat on, where I'm a facilitator and so on, is getting other people to appreciate that. You know, and that's whether that's getting partners on board, getting funders on board, getting maybe parents on board, you know, whatever it is, you know, to appreciate that dance is more than just about the physical movement and so on. So it's lighting the spark in the individual who's joining in, but then hopefully that filters out. And, you know, my role is to really advocate for that beyond the dance class. And then the sort of third goal, I guess, is for people to become, want to do it for themselves. And, you know, we've talked a lot on the course about active learners and so forth, but for them to consciously recognize that. And that's a bit of a journey in my experience. So many people come to the class and they expect or they want to just be told what to do. And that's a cultural thing in terms of how dance has been taught. And I get it as well, because sometimes you just want to come. You don't want to think. You just want to switch off, be told what to do. And sometimes I will go to a class like that and I love it because, you know, I'm just doing it and I'm not having to consciously engage my brain. But if people continue on that journey, I want them to get to the point where they're doing it more actively for themselves and they're really understanding what they want to get out of it. Where, you know, and that could be all sorts of different things, but they're making those conscious choices of how they want to engage and what they want to get out of it, rather than, yeah, me being the demagogue telling them every which way to move and what to do and how to move and so forth. So yeah, there's like a progression of goals there, I think.
I mean, you've kind of started answering this already, but what are the barriers then that get in the way of achieving these goals?
Well, yeah, so the one I mentioned is like participant expectations / aspirations / preconceptions. So it's the what they come with in their already understanding of what they're going to experience in the dance class. So that traditional format, which so many people have done through night doing ballet when they were teeny tots or whatever, is that they come, they'd be told what to do, and they do it to the best of their ability. And I think that's where we come up against the issues of, oh, I can't dance. Because if the dance you're being taught is not within your skill set or your style or whatever, then yeah, you're going to go, oh, I can't do that. And that's going to put you off. So those conceptions, and I struggle with that most with teens and adults, because they come and just want to be told what to do. And they find it quite unsettling sometimes when we put in, you know, the more creative aspects or the elements of choice within the class. And teenagers, yeah, they just want to learn all the tricks, all the fancy tricks, and not appreciate the steps you need to take to get to do those tricks without breaking something. Time is always a barrier. There's never enough time, and just the time to you know, plan adequately and to have the time to, you know, you need time to talk in a class as well, but then you're only, you know, you've got an hour or an hour and a half or whatever it is, and you want people to move as well and leave feeling that they've achieved something. So it's always managing that time within a session with the group you've got to balance all those things out. Another barrier is, you know, personal, and it's based on, you know, my lifelong experience. And, you know, I started classes when I was 5, and I'm a bit older than that now, just a little bit. And it's very easy to fall back on, you know, what you know, in the sense of like those habits are very ingrained, and it gets less so, but it's still like, you know, you have to make conscious decisions to go, no, I'm not going to do that. Or if I am going to do it in that traditional way, why am I doing it in that traditional way? And making sure that the people you're teaching understand why you're doing it that way, because there's a purpose to it rather than just because that's easy. So that's a barrier in myself, is just keep remembering to center the learner, be clear what I'm wanting to achieve in any given session. So yeah, I don't just like fall back into habits. even if they want me to, because that's what they want. It's like challenging them, but taking them on the journey so they feel safe, secure, comfortable to have those moments of like, yeah, you're going to make a choice here. You're going to be creative or whatever it is. I think so. Yeah.
I mean, we'll get you just kind of moving into the next question as well around what strategies do you use to help you achieve your goal or, and or deal with the barriers?
So for the barrier within myself is just to really plan in time for planning. I think so often, you know, we can get caught up with, oh, I just need to finish off this project proposal. I just need to finish off reporting on such and such or whatever it is, because my role is so multifaceted. And I didn't used to consciously put in the block of time to plan. And now I'm very conscious about putting that time in. And sometimes it's on the day, depending what it is, or sometimes it's a week in advance. I just need to sit down, you know, at the computer and just watch loads of other stuff or research something. And then sometimes it's on the day, having that hour before the class to go, right, what is it we're doing? Recap what we've done. Where are we aiming to get to? Yeah, so there's different levels of planning, different methods of planning. So that's really important strategy, which I've learned sort of in the sort of second half of, I suppose, my teaching career. Another the strategy in terms of overcoming the participant expectations is subterfuge. It's just sneaking things into the class without people necessarily realizing, or they realize, but it's in such a way that it's not overwhelming. So it might be just the first warm-up is much freer rather than a set exercise. It's more like a structured improvisation. It might be that we have a phrase of set material, but within that there'll be sections where for however many counts they're going to improvise on a theme, you know. It might be just giving them a traveling sequence where I've given them a time structure but not a movement structure. So it's like, but it's not necessarily the whole session. So it's finding ways in, which I think everyone now, particularly if you've worked in inclusive dance practice for people with, you know, additional needs and so on, you have a really creative practice and you have loads of tasks and exercises and mechanisms to get people moving. And so it's utilizing them. I utilize that a lot now with all my classes to just get them more comfortable with like that freedom of movement, making creative choices. I mean, improvisation terrifies people and it used to terrify me, but you can do it in such a structured way that it leads people in. So yeah, subterfuge. They think they're coming to a technique class, but then maybe it's not all technique. And then really important strategy throughout is reflection and continuing professional development. You know, so I do try and I've always tried to keep going to different classes, other people's classes, go to courses, do masters, obviously. but whatever it is, you know, practical and theoretical, intellectual, just keep refreshing yourself because you can become so stale otherwise. And I really see that in peers, that they don't go back or challenge themselves or reflect on what they're doing, and they don't continue to sort of train, as it were. There's a lot of people who think, oh, I've done my training and now this is it, kind of thing. And I think that's sounds a strong word, dangerous almost, because if you think you know it all, then you definitely don't. and I do encourage that. And a part of my work is like trying to encourage that with the people we work with, the freelance team and our team and so forth. And yeah, the people we work with are great and are on that journey as well. But it's like, if you really value that kind of input, you know, you could be an amazing dancer, but you can go to a beginner's class and still get loads out of it. Because you know that there's always something to learn. So yeah, that's a definite strategy. And particularly, you know, I've been around for a while. And if you want to keep doing it, you've got to keep inputting to yourself, like feeding yourself, because you're giving out in this role all the time and giving a lot of yourself all the time. So you really need to feed yourself.
Great. Thanks, Louise. So how do you measure your success as an arts educator?
Well, we have the formal mechanisms of, you know, monitoring and evaluation, which I'm not going to go into massive detail about because we know all about that on funding applications and all the rest of it. And they're very dry. I think we, as a department, engagement department at Eden Court, are very good in terms of our monitoring and evaluation and not letting it get too dry, because we use a real multiplicity of approaches. We've obviously got forms for some people, whether they be online or otherwise, but we do a lot of Fox Pops, little film clips, photograph kind of evidence and so forth as well. So we have a much broader range of feedback. So it's not all about the numbers. Some people, some funders just want the numbers, but you know, it's great to illustrate that much more. On a more personal level, you know, it's direct feedback. The direct feedback you get in the class, you know yourself how it's going, kind of thing. I mean, and as a good facilitator, you're going to be monitoring that all the time that you're teaching, however consciously or unconsciously. If you feel, oh, I need to change, I need to slow down, I need to speed up. But it's like, you know, the feedback you get directly from people at the end, you know, do they look like they've had a good time? Are they positive? Are they talking to you? What are they telling you? Do they come back? That's quite a significant one. And I feel very fortunate that I have people who, you know, danced with me as a kid and they go off to uni and then they come back and they come back as an adult. I've had people who started dancing with me like when they were three and they've gone all the way through until they've left university. And, you know, that's obviously a really positive endorsement. And it's not just down to me. It's definitely down to the culture and the environment that we create at Eden Court. People feel part of that community. But also all of us who are facilitating have a responsibility to make sure we nurture that. But yeah, that direct feedback is, you know, invaluable and sometimes the hardest to capture in lots of ways. Whether I've enjoyed it or not as well, I think often is a really good indicator. If I've not enjoyed something, then it's probably highly likely that the people there haven't enjoyed it all that much either. And I often say at the end of my class, thank you for coming to play, because it feels like that. If it's gone really well, it's just like we've played together, had fun together, which is great. Yeah, I think that's all, apart from the obvious methods.
And how would you describe the ideal relationship between you and your learner?
Well, reciprocal, a partnership, back and forth. And that's when I was talking about the goals, that's when you want to get to that point where they're there as because they enjoy it, but also because they've identified and know what they want to get out of it, because then they will feedback to me or talk to me or ask questions or help steer the direction of where whatever we're doing is going. So it's not all about me. So it's a two-way thing. So, and I'm really conscious of this, especially with adolescents. I really try and get them to be on board with me and take some ownership of what we're doing. So I'm always saying, what do you think? Asking, you know, what do you think about this? Asking for input, getting them to suggest, you know, it starts with something simple like music, so that they feel it's a partnership, that we're sharing the journey together and not just, and often, you know, they can do things that I can't do. So I'll get them to teach, you know, them to show their partners and their peers, because I can't do it. And I'm certain things I'm certainly not going to learn now with the best will in the world. So it's giving those opportunities, getting them to maybe lead a warm up and different things as well. So that they, and it's where you position yourself in the class. Like, I don't always stand at the front. I sometimes just stand in the body of the class and do it with them and things like that. So that, yeah, developing that partnership relationship. And the people that, you know, have been coming a long time and keep coming, they definitely feel that and feel that they are a part of something. They're not just an attendee kind of thing. They're definitely a participant, and that's really important. So,
and what job title are you most comfortable with?
Probably not the one I've got at the moment. Mostly because it's just really long. And interestingly, when I first started in the job very many moons ago, I think it was advertised as a dance and movement leader. And we changed that within weeks because it was horrible. So I think I was a dance artist for a long time. And I would say a teaching artist is definitely my most comfortable title. And it's interesting because very often people who teach or facilitate, maybe have been performers in whatever art form, or maybe are thwarted performers, or maybe aspirational performers. And I think that must be really hard to juggle that, your own, what you want, and then teaching, you know, maybe because that's where you can get work, or, you know, you might enjoy it as well, but it's maybe not your primary thing, or it might be a parallel sort of career. But for me, I'm definitely never wanted to be a performer, even though I came back to it a bit late, to back to dance, that is. And I think there is artistry in the teaching. It's not just about being an artist with my own practice who also teaches, if that makes sense. So I think some people take the title teaching artist because they are an artist in their own right and they teach, which is valid as well. But I definitely think my creativity and so on is in the teaching, not just in the moves, the choreography, whatever. So yeah, happiest with teaching artist.
Great, thank you. What three values are central to your practice as an arts educator?
Three values? Oh my God, that's a hard one. I should be able to answer that really easily, shouldn't I? But I've never framed it like that. Three values. Oh my God, I might have to come back to that. You might have to edit that bit. That's really okay. Hard.
We can come back to it. That's fine. Give you time to think about it. We can edit a large chunk of silence if you want to have a think about it.
One value that definitely inclusion. Mm-hmm. And that covers everybody. Ambition, I guess, is a value. And that's not necessarily in the sort of professional sense of the word of ambition, but ambition in terms of wanting everyone to achieve what they want to achieve at whatever level that is. So that's two: inclusion, ambition. I suppose, I don't know if it counts as a value, but enjoyment, because that should be the most important thing. If you don't enjoy it, then there's no point. So yeah, I think those are probably the three values that come to mind first.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Slight switch of focus. If you could have a mentor from any time in history, real or fictional, to support your arts practice, who would you choose?
Now, you did send this question in advance, and I have been thinking about it, and I really, really struggled. I can't, and this is perhaps down to me, I can't think of one person I would choose as a mentor. There's loads of people that I've met, or historical people that are massively inspirational and so forth, people I've worked with, but I don't have one person I could choose. And I think that's partly due to my eclectic nature, and the nature of the role is very eclectic, in that you're always like, picking up on different things from different people, different companies, different organizations all the time. And so I go through fads, you know, I'll have a fan phase for somebody and then like move on to the next person, which sounds terrible, doesn't it? But they've all, you know, been massively influential. I've had some great teachers and just people you see from afar. So yeah, it's really hard to pick one person.
Having framed it in such a way that it's always constantly changing, if it was today and you could speak to one mentor,
if I could speak to one person today, probably Leonardo da Vinci.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because he was so multi-talented. And I'd love to know how he managed to keep all those strands, like the artistry and the science and the curiosity and the, you know, persistence and perseverance going, all of that across all those different areas, getting lost in it.
Would that be your question? Because that's the next thing. What question would you ask him? So if you could frame that as a question, what would that question be?
Yeah, how do you remain focused yet able to engage across such diverse topics, because I do want to know everything. I want to learn everything, not just in dance. I want literally want to learn everything. It's not going to happen. I'm running out of time, but
what do you think he would answer?
What would he answer? How does he do it? I think he would be like, what a daft question. It's obvious, because I think he was just so passionate. You know, his curiosity was what drove him. So he would like be like, well, why are you even asking me that? Does that make sense?
That's absolutely fine. If that's what you would say, that's what you'd say.
I don't know if it's what he would say. Just be like, yeah, just get on with it.
Excellent. Yeah. And finally, is there anything else you'd like to say about your arts education practice?
Just, yeah, for people who are like looking at it as a career or in it as a career, it's just never done. You know, you're never finished. And if you want to do it and do it really well, I think you have to commit to that and not have like these dual aspirations. That sounds a bit harsh maybe, but I think it's been like, you know, the poor relation, community arts practice especially, but, you know, teaching, you know, historically in dance, you would have someone who was an amazing performer, and when they couldn't perform anymore, they'd either become a teacher or a choreographer. So it's always been and choreographer obviously had higher status than a teacher. And then there's still, I think, a hierarchy within the teaching of dance world, you know, that, oh, you teach at whatever, you know, esteemed training college or whatever. And then it comes down, and then there's still the community practitioners at the bottom, which I completely don't agree with. And it's fantastic places like ITAC are starting to, you know, really advocate, because definitely within community or participatory arts practice, we change people's lives, and probably more fundamentally than people who are training to be a dance professional, because they already know that, they're already on that pathway, and you're honing them, helping them hone their skills. And the people, like we always say, you know, we might not, I'm sure it's not our original quote, but within engagement, we say, you know, we might not create, you know, the next, you know, Hollywood actor, but we might help support a really passionate and confident plumber. And that's fine, because it's about all those skills around what we do. It's wonderful if someone loves dance and they carry on dancing and, you know, in whatever capacity, but that's not the single goal of a teaching artist, I don't think. So yeah, I really value like ITAC, People Dancing, which is a UK organization for participatory arts. I happen to be on the board, but you know, they do great work advocating for community and participatory dance practice, and all those kind of things. I think, you know, we need to tip it on its head. And it's interesting, the Let's Create criteria in the ACE funding, Arts Council England funding, is doing something about tipping that on its head, because it's really about the engagement and participation, which has obviously just upset a lot of people who lost their funding in London, unfortunately, but there just isn't enough funding to go around. But it is tipping that balance, but that hierarchy is still there, which I think is very detrimental. And it's just ignorant as well.
Thank you very much, Louise. I've really enjoyed your responses, and I really thank you for joining us and sharing your views.
You're welcome.
For more podcasts in this series, go to portal.rcs.ac.uk/arts-educator-interviews.